Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have a great group this morning. We'll get started. And let me introduce everyone to you. A reminder that you can certainly get in, and we would love to hear your thoughts on what we're talking about today. All you have to do is write to panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'll get to your letters a little bit later on once we start the conversation. Now, let me introduce everybody to you so you know who is here. Jim Henler joins us. He is the Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Always a pleasure to have him on our program. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Jim.
Very nice to have you with us. Judy Patrick is here, VP of Editorial Development for the New York Press Association, fresh off a taping of the Media Project, so she's raring to go.
Oh, boy, am I.
Good to be here. Good to have you. Hey, look who's visiting. Former Albany Common Council President Helen DeFossis is with us, fresh from the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Where we have crazy politics.
Where
right
nothing
now.
Is going on.
A lot of commons in there.
Yeah. Well, let's. We welcome you, Helen. Thank you very much for coming in.
It's great to be back.
Wonderful to have you visiting. And you all right? Are you good?
I'm standing up. You don't really want to know why.
Okay.
All right. I'm standing up because I had pistachio nuts.
You see,
I have a handful of shells.
Oh, do you want?
I don't want to put them in my pocket. I was going to walk around in
here.
A bag.
Oh,
thank you. Thank you very much.
There you go.
Now I can sit down.
That's right.
And shut up.
No, not at all. We're very interested in you and your nuts. Okay, so.
Sorry.
Good morning, Alan. How's everything? You doing all right?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Good. Good. Welcome, everybody. Very nice to have you with us. Okay, so let's go on with what is happening. A federal judge finds that Paul Manafort lied to the Mueller probe about contacts with a Russian aide. Can you imagine that Paul Manafort lied? Well, the finding is that 69-year-old Paul Manafort breached his cooperation deal with prosecutors by lying after his guilty plea. It could add years to his prison sentence and came after a set of sealed court hearings. Manafort's lies, the judge found, included his interactions and communications with a Russian operative, a Russian political operative, a longtime aide whom the FBI assessed to have ties to Russian intelligence. The judge in this case, U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson, thank you, Alan, of the district, said that Manafort also lied to the special counsel, the FBI, and the grand jury about a payment from a company to a law firm. Okay, so what does this all mean? This happened just blocks away from the Trump Tower, by the way, August 2nd, 2016.
I think somehow it means that the rewards for lying were greater than the penalties for lying. He knew what the penalties were. I mean, he's a very, very smart man. But for some reason, he was so scared of telling the truth that he didn't tell the truth.
Well, so, then go there, Helen. What exactly were the potential some reasons?
What?
In other words, what were the some reasons that he was afraid to go? He was afraid of the power of the President of the United
States? That's what I'm thinking, yes. That's what I'm thinking.
Or the other way around, he was thinking that maybe he'd get pardoned, and he could just hold out on the most secretive of information in order to make that happen.
Yeah, but the lies were, you know, just so detrimental to his future. And now he's ill. He's a shadow of his former self. I mean, he's bent over and stooped and doesn't even look like the Paul Manafort we knew. I mean, he knew he was getting to something really heavy either way and chose to really take one path rather than the other.
Yeah. I don't think he was very smart. I think he was stupid. I think he thought he could get away with these lies. I think he thought that the prosecutors wouldn't be able to nail down this information. You know, especially troubling to me as I looked at this story was the idea that he may have shared polling data with the Russians. And that is key because polling data, I mean, I'm not into internal polling data of campaigns, but my understanding is they use it to determine who to target and who not to target in terms of what messages to send out. So this is crucial.
Would that be, wait for it, collusion?
Well, look, here's what I can never get over. I can't understand about an assemblyman who takes a bribe. I can't understand about Jill Abramson, we were talking about that on the Media Project, you know, plagiarizing, when she certainly knows what plagiarism is all about. I can't understand why people do things that are so detrimental to their self-interest. It doesn't make any sense to me. I've never been able to figure it out.
But you assume they think they can get away with it, right?
Yes.
So this is back to both...
I'm sorry for interrupting, but also it often means, Joe, that they have been getting away with it
on
some level or another, and they're just doing it again.
Well,
so
it's pretty clear that he was sharing the polling data. And one theory is that his business interests, he really wanted to support and, you know, promote his own business interests, and he was on a roll, he thought.
This idea of whether he was smart or dumb, though, I do think, I mean, we'll never figure that out, obviously, but I find it interesting because when you go to the plea deal and you wonder and you think, oh, well, no one can ever find this story out to be false, but his second in command, the guy who was doing everything, Rick Gates, had already agreed to cooperate with federal authorities. I don't know why you wouldn't think that would come back and haunt you.
Well, first of all, you're right. But second of all, you don't know what goes, as the shadow used to say, what evil lurks in the hearts of man or women. Only the shadow knew. And the reason I'm raising that is he may have thought he had a deal with Gates also.
Well, that's a good point.
He may have thought that Gates, you know, was gonna cover the same territory he was.
Jim Hendler.
You know, to me, it's the whole pattern of all this, and it's that, you know, to me, I think it's mostly hubris. It's this complete belief that these people have that they're above the law. And, you know, you saw a lot of that around the campaign. Mm-hmm. We could discuss whether you see that around the White House or not. I suspect your listeners know where I stand on that. But, again, it's just this notion that somehow people are above the law, that this is an inconvenience, and that they just weren't going to get caught. And so, you know, lying to prosecutors and things like that, most people seem to know that that's a bad idea. But when you hit a certain level, they're just sort of, I can do what I want. You know, you saw some of that also on the criminal side with El Chapo. It's just everything these days seems to be, it's all about me, my greed, and, you know, I'm above the law. And then that whole way of thinking, I wasn't raised that way. What can I say? And so I'm like, Alan, you know, you can never quite understand why these people do these things. But,
you know, he's lied so much at this point that he's useless to prosecutors. I wouldn't,
right.
If I was the Mueller team, wouldn't give him anything. What can he put him on the stand, and he's no jury is going to believe anything he has to say.
So,
well,
go ahead,
Judy, in all honesty, I don't fully subscribe to that idea. Look, we prosecutors have to go get people to testify. And quite often when there is a criminal matter going on, they choose accomplices and others who really are just not the salt of the earth, but they use them because they have to. It's all they got.
So next up is he'll be resentenced, right? He'll be sentenced to additional.
This is later in March.
Wait.
Yes.
There's one more thing.
Yes.
Is this a play on the part of Mueller to get him to come forward even more? In other words, is there a possibility that by doing it this way, he gets him to come clean? Now, we're told that this is the end of the Mueller investigation, that it's all being wrapped up and that's going on. But, you know, if you have a guy like Manafort, who was the campaign manager and who has talked to these Russians and everything else, to really come clean and say the smoking gun... But I was told to do this by the president. That's different.
But isn't that, to Judy's point, that, you know, how do you trust this guy now?
Well, you trust him because he's what you got.
Well, the new fight in the Washington area now is what's going to happen to the Mueller report. I mean, how are they going to publicize it? Is he going to sit on it? What's going to happen? That's where the real fisticuffs are going on in Washington politics right now.
We are so aware of that. And we saw him, we all sat there and watched that television when he said, rather convincingly, I thought, as much as possible, I'll get it out there. But it was when he said as much as possible.
Yeah, those are the code words.
That's where everybody got a little bit nervous during this. Do you really think that the legislature, that the Congress is going to let him get away with issuing the report and not putting it out there?
How does it not get leaked in some way, shape, or form?
Well, up to now, Mueller has not leaked anything.
But no, but once you issue it to, because Congress would still get it, right? Congress?
No, no. It just goes, no, it just goes to the Attorney General. And the Attorney General has to make sure where it goes. And the Congress, guys like Jerry Nadler and other people, are making it clear that that would be unsatisfactory, that they'll subpoena it. But then you get, you know, this executive-legislative fight that we see so often.
Well, and, of course, the politics of 2020 are already figuring into all of this. I mean, when you say, what is the Congress going to do? What do they think is going to happen to them one way or the other? Are they going to be tainted more if they help, if they don't help? I don't know. Everybody's really holding their breath in the Washington area right now.
Well, you know, those Republican senators have not gotten off the dime. They have not gotten off the dime. And the question is this the time? Will this be the make or break for so many of them? I think they're all in trouble to begin with.
Yeah, but so far nothing's been able to budge them.
That's right. That's right.
So when you look at this, I guess, overall of what it means for Manafort, and I guess I'm thinking of following up on what Alan said, of if there is more and if this is a play, then that would indicate that this is going to go, the investigation will go on a little bit longer.
We have no idea.
Yeah.
That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, whether they would want to play it out longer. I mean, to minimize his impact on the 2020 elections that are already building up to a degree that I never thought we'd see them so early in the game. I mean, Klobuchar in the snow the other day was so evocative of all the JFK footage we saw years ago in the snow. I mean, it was an incredible appearance and performance. So anyway, we've got a lot of electoral politics for 2020 that are already figuring in here.
It makes me, it's reminiscent of the Watergate hearings where, remember, whether or not they're going to let somebody hang and twist in the wind, are they letting Manafort twist in the wind for a while and see what he'll do?
Jim?
I
saw you shaking your head. I didn't know if it was
general comment on politics in America. No, I was just thinking about the 2020 campaign already starting. So.
You know, in D.C., national politics are local politics. When you live in Virginia, that's all you see is national politics on TV. And, Joe, there are a lot of people twisting in the winds already. I mean, to use this metaphor. In fact, I read that metaphors are becoming so important in national politics now because they had to come up with something for the president, some shortcut for his mind to focus on when he made a speech, and build the wall, just really caught his attention. So now he's build the wall everywhere
Finish
he goes.
The wall,
and now other people are fighting him with other metaphors, trying to get a competing story out, right? That's what anybody who wants to be elected is going to have to do, beat him at his own story.
Just to put this one step forward to extrapolate a bit, it seems to me that whenever Mueller releases the report, and if it becomes somewhat public and we know something, there's going to have to be a narrative written. And it seems to me that it is so confusing and so complex, it has such complexity, that is a very difficult narrative to A, tell, but to B, explain to the American people so that they will understand as to, I mean, I'm myself included in that, of knowing what is right, what is wrong, and how you are supposed to process
now,
that.
Now, that's the job of the press. We have Judy with us, who you see these voluminous reports and other things come out. And then you see the guys and women sitting there going, blah, 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 and boy, it's as if I was talking to a guy before who could look at any novel and he could find within 3 seconds the sex passages in the novel.
That was me, by the way.
Book show.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
And so you think, you know, when you've seen these folks at work, they really can go fast. I mean, 5 minutes after they've got their hands on it, they can say, this is it.
No, you're right. That's amazing.
And it's also the potential for, pardon me, pack journalism. Because once that first guy yells out, this is it, I found it.
There's really nothing more boring to most people than an indictment to read.
Right.
That. They're so plotting. They have to lay it out step by step. Crime reporters find it really fascinating. District attorneys find it really fascinating. But you're right. The people have to go into it and then translate it into common English. And that's where people are going to say, this is where you're biased one way or the other.
Now, obviously, but when you have the charges, that'll be a little bit easier to figure out as to what whoever is charged with and does it, and we will know fairly quickly of whether it's connected to the President of the United States or not.
See, the President has so maligned the press, though. You know, he's so undermined their role and people's belief in their role that whoever's trying to control the narrative or even get the truth out, if they're parts of the press, they could be immediately suspect.
This is a great we have a great history of despots doing exactly this, you know, in the past. However, remember that the Trump and his other people, Meadows and this Freedom Caucus, they're all playing to that 30%. 30%. You know, it's good. They may be able to convince the 30%, but there's still 70% out there who are at stake.
But, you know, I think the key thing that I would like to point out is we keep talking about the narrative, but there's going to be at least two, not many. So the other thing that's happened in this press stuff is not even so much making people not believe the press as the balkanization. So you've got the right press, the left. So, you know, depending who you're listening to, you're going to hear a completely different story about what the report says, what happens, who are these people, what were they doing, did it matter? It's you know, there really isn't this kind of you know, as a scientist, I'm always so upset when there's not like a set of facts. You could just say, when these are the facts, what do? When you get into politics, it's
but
all
but even in science, we don't have those anymore, do we?
Well, that's a good point, Joe. I was going to make
we
it
do.
Off.
There's just a question of which side of the media is listening to you that week.
Exactly. So. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We'll talk about a border deal and how that's all going. Will the president sign or not? And how that will play out. We welcome your letters as always, panel@wamc.org. We will be back right after this short break. Lyndon LaRoche died.
Wow.
96 years old. Ran for president 8 times.
Proving once again only the good die young.
That's right.
Yeah, that politics is good for the soul. That's clearly true. Look at him.
I remember in 1984 he was running for president. I lived in Philadelphia and there was the primary going on and Gary Hart and Walter Mondale and all the candidates were coming in, and I just remember being in City Hall and watching Lyndon LaRoche go down Market Street in the back of a VW Rabbit without doors on it, just waving to people, honking, asking for people for his vote. It was very interesting, but 96 years old.
So I was living in Texas in the mid-80s, and you couldn't go into like a supermarket or anything without the table outside full of the LaRochers who had their pamphlets full of some of the strangest
conspiracy theories.
Yeah, and now those wouldn't even register as conspiracy. Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
Compared to what's going on in this government. But.
There was a line. We'll move on to the stuff, but there was a line in the Times obit that I thought was great. Was defining what Lyndon LaRoche stands for was no easy task. I like that. All right, let's go to some. We only got a letter or two, so we welcome yours, panel@wamc.org. We'll go to the letters, and then we'll move on to other topics. Does that sound good?
That sounds good. By the way, you know, sometimes people send letters, and it takes us a few minutes to print them up and get. So
yeah.
There's more than just a few, but I've just been checking my mail. But we'll read these two to begin with, okay?
Sounds good.
Ann said, "Dear panel, has anyone considered that Manafort lied because he fears retaliation from the Russians? You know, we had positive before from the White House. He was playing for very high stakes with ruthless people."
Oh, that's a good point. I saw all those movies, too, in the 80s and 90s, you know? Yeah. Russian spy movies, they were always vicious and couldn't reason with them in any way.
Well, I don't think there's any question that Putin has a vicious streak in him, which has allowed him to rub out his enemies, you know, in the past. That's a very fascinating thing for us to chew on.
But meanwhile, look at the relationship that Trump has cultivated with Putin. You know, that's closer than we've ever seen between a president of our country and the head of their country. What's that all about? And is he expecting that to reap any benefits?
And will we ever forget when he first got up there and said, I love the Russians, I love the Russians. You know, get me all the material on Hillary you can.
Yeah.
And he wasn't lying for once. He was telling the truth. He does love the Russians, and they do have him by, you know, what would be the appropriate thing to say on the radio?
Short hairs.
Yes, they do have him, in a compromised position, I suspect.
Hey, you got one more letter there, Alan.
I do. Thanks, Joe, for pointing that out. Joel says, why do they think they can get away with it? The Greeks had a word for it. Hubris.
Oh, hubris, yeah.
Yeah, we've used it.
I think so, yeah. Well, somebody mentioned hubris.
I have it written down on my page. I must have said it.
Hubris. Greek hybris. In ancient Athens, the intentional use of violence to humiliate or degrade. The word's connotation changed over time, and hubris came to be defined as overwhelming presumption that leads a person to disregard the divinely fixed limits on human action in an ordered cosmos.
I just got to say, public radio.
Yeah, I was going, wow.
This is wonderful. I'm so glad I'm back.
So,
really.
Alan, now I'm sorry I didn't say chutzpah.
Well, it is interesting because chutzpah
has... The letter probably would have been shorter than that.
We'll get another one now, yeah. I hope.
Chutzpah has entered the common parlance not a Yiddish word, but as, you know, example of incredible gall.
So Dateline Washington, D.C., lawmakers slogged toward completion of a massive spending bill and border security compromise on Wednesday, preparing to pass it and send it to President Trump in time to avoid a government shutdown Friday at midnight. The mood in the Capitol was less of enthusiasm than relief as negotiators finalized legislation that would end, for now, political brinkmanship over Trump's demands for money for a southern border wall. Those demands produced the nation's longest partial government shutdown before it ended late last month after 35 days. This from the Washington Post. The days of negotiations that followed produced a deal offering Trump less than a quarter of the $5.7 billion that he wanted for barriers along the U.S.-Mexico border. Nevertheless, Trump is expected to sign the bill, although the president has changed his mind at the last minute before, creating a level of uncertainty. Lawmakers finalized the 1,159-page bill just before midnight Wednesday, and votes were expected in the House and Senate today. The legislation is expected to pass. Trump said that he has to see the final deal before deciding whether he can support it, but he reiterated his insistence that regardless of what Congress does, the border wall will get built.
Did you see where Trump has called a couple of Fox News commentators, and he's trying to get them to support his side of the narrative here because he's being accused of having sold out too easily on the question of the wall. And so he's really, he feels up against it, that his reputation is being sullied, that his persona as a fighter is being sullied. And so he got on the phone with a couple of these guys.
Yes, and he had his people, many of whom have been recruited from Fox,
yes,
making those phone calls also. But I have to say, I've said it before, I love to quote myself.
And we love when you do it.
There's a rock, he's between a rock and a hard place. But the beautiful thing here is that he has created, he's built that rock and that hard place himself. So in other words, he is now, he cannot, the Republicans in the United States Senate will not let him jeopardize their own reelection going back into a government shutdown. So on the one hand, and on the other hand, he's got the Rush Limbaughs and all the rest of those guys ready to, you know, choke him in the throat.
But I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, it's just so infuriating, though, to see, this personal opinion here, but you watch as dysfunctional as it may be, you have the House, you have the Senate, you have negotiators who are trying to hammer together a deal. They're working, and then suddenly it comes down to Fox News commentators.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you called it the fourth rail of the
fifth estate.
Right. It's insane that we've reached that, to me.
Anyway,
you know,
Stephen,
president.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry.
Please. No.
The president keeps threatening to declare a state of national emergency, too. And that's a very, very scary thing.
For the Republicans, it is.
It's not. Well, it's not just it's not like running out into the street and saying emergency, emergency. I mean, it carries a lot of political implications that the government couldn't function adequately. It couldn't handle the questions on its own.
But it's a threat to threat to democracy, right?
Yes.
But here's the problem. And McConnell knows it and is basically saying so. What if Klobuchar becomes or one of those guys becomes the president of the United States? With one fell swoop, they can emergencize all of those things that Trump has done, and they don't want to let that happen.
No, I mean we're at a few precipices here that are pretty nerve-wracking, I must say, politically.
Well, Stephen,
there is one thing that seems very likely. What the president will do as his face saver is take money that's already allocated, vaguely move it.
That's right.
There'll be a lot of yelling and screaming, but you know he has the power to do it. Can do it fairly easily. We'll be able to claim he's outdone the Democrats. So
maybe
you know. So as long as So the real question becomes, how much is are the Ann Coulters and people like that going to put his back up to where he has to do the emergency?
I hope
that the real politic will drive him towards that middle.
It's not so easy. As Professor DeFossis will tell us, having taught this subject for a long time, we have three branches of government. And one of those branches, the United States Congress, appropriates money for specific tasks. And if you can see that he has taken something away from something that's been appropriated, for example, for the Army or for one of these places, and put it towards his wall, that could be fodder for a federal lawsuit.
Yeah, although it sounds like the Pentagon is already moving over a little bit to allow him some maneuverability, helping him to find a few accounts here and there, of course, with hundreds of millions of dollars in them. I don't know. I mean, it's chess at the very highest level of scary too that's going on right
scary
now.
Scary too. I like it.
If you just heard my a little ding, that was my watch telling me that there was a breaking news alert. So former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe says that justice officials discussed recruiting cabinet members to push Trump out of office. The former Deputy FBI Director said the top Justice Department officials were alarmed by President Trump's decision in May of 2017 to fire James Comey, the Bureau's director. The concerns also prompted Mr. McCabe to order the FBI's team investigating Russia's election interference to look into whether Mr. Trump had obstructed justice by firing Mr. Comey.
And that was right before Trump said to the Russians, "I've taken care of the Russian thing," you know, by firing him. I mean, that's extraordinary.
Joe, who was the statement made to?
I'm sorry, what do you mean? Oh, who did McCabe talk to?
Yes.
In an interview.
By the way, we knew this.
It's part of a 60 Minutes interview.
But that helps the president out, too. You know, the more that it looks like there's a cabal against him that's being organized from within his own administration, I mean, it really makes him a hero to his base. And maybe a little bit more of the base, although he doesn't care particularly about coalition building. But his base is very strong, and that helps him. It sounds like there's a big conspiracy against the president.
And speaking of conspiracies, Helen, I want you to know that I was quite taken, and I said so on this program the other day, by the fact that Rasmussen, the poll, as I've often described it, the best Republican poll that money can buy, had him above 50%, Trump's approval rating, for the first time. So I went and checked it against all the others, and all the others are in the high 30s, very low 40s.
Really?
So isn't that interesting?
That is very interesting.
Still high.
Well, no, for him. So the feeling is his base is around 35, that you would go below that.
Right,
you
where
really
it's always been.
Thing. Right, yeah. And so going up towards 40 is actually for him pushing a little. But.
Stephen says, Lyndon LaRoche. I remember him as a guy who asserted that Queen Elizabeth controlled the opiate market.
Yep.
And that's from Steve.
No, kidding.
So LaRoche believed that the Brits never really gave up control of America. And there was just this stunning stuff in their pamphlets about you know, declaring war on England. Then there were other LaRouchers who actually felt that the biggest mistake we ever made was declaring independence from England. So they also had pamphlets that said why we should bring the Queen back. And so it was, as just said, it was hard to tell where they stood sometimes.
Well, when I was city council president in Albany, there was an ordinance. People wanted to fluoridate the water. And people came up from Long Island on buses against this with pamphlets that said fluoride is a communist plot. So a lot of these things, they never die, you know, in politics.
Oh, that's been going on since the 90s. I remember in the 50s in Manhattan with the fluoride thing.
And anti-vaccine.
But the same pamphlets, they were yellowed pamphlets, and people had them from the 50s with a hammer and sickle and a fluoride tube on the front.
And remember, he started out, LaRouche, as a born in the wool, Marxist.
Yeah.
He was a Marxist.
Yeah. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll go to letters and move on to other topics. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Helen DeFossis is here, and Jim Hendler. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. We have letters. Let's do the few that we have, and we'll move on to other stuff.
Ellen says, Manafort. Hi, panel. I see the value of Manafort testifying before Congress rather than in court or to Mueller. The Atlantic lays out the case for impeachment that makes a lot of sense to me. Alan, any chance you're willing to reconsider your position? And that's Ellen from Greenfield. Well, since you asked, Ellen, no. And the reason is...
Well, that was quick.
I am all for impeaching this guy, but not uselessly. Right now, you impeach him and you send it to the Senate, they're going to vote no. Yep. They are going to vote no. They're not going to do it. You have to wait for the Mueller report and see whether there's a smoking gun in there, and then you got an impeachable case. So for you to put words in my mouth, Ellen, and people will criticize me for responding this way, is not good, because I never said I was opposed to impeachment. I was said I've been imposed, opposed to impeachment now, and who do I think is the great mind who is thinking correctly on this? That's right, Richie Neal, who is being attacked assiduously for not going faster, and he says you got to keep it slow and you got to make sure you're in position to do it. And I think Richie Neal's terrific, my favorite congressman.
It's not easy to impeach either.
No.
You know, you can't just keep waving that around as a threat and then actually try to do it without all your ducks in a row.
I'm all for it.
Awful.
Okay, Ellen.
Well,
thanks.
So I'll even tell you the piece that, you know, this inside baseball. There's a whole lot of people I know in the Democratic side who are hoping there isn't a smoking gun.
There
because
isn't.
They would much rather run against a
Trump.
A damaged Trump than
you're exactly right.
Empowered Pence.
You're exactly right.
Wow.
And in fact, that is exactly what happened with the House of Representatives just now and the New York State Senate, which could never be brought over to the other side. It was Trump, ironically, Trump, who produced this result, and they want it to happen again. And I think it's a good point. Dear esteemed panel, says Rick, thanks for being there with your insightful commentary. I seem to remember from high school history that our revolution had support of about one-third of the population, one-third loyalists, and one-third didn't care. Hitler came to power elected by 44%. We can't write off the Trump base. Love to hear your thoughts. Rick in Latham.
But wait, there's more. Go ahead.
You know, I think that's a good point. You know, when I was, I guess it was almost 30 years ago, I spent a year in Israel on a Fulbright and was talking a lot about American politics. And we used to say back then there were sort of 30% on one side, 30% on the other side. And it was the 40 in the middle that made the decision on almost anything. They were trying to understand this two-party system.
Exactly right.
Now the problem is it's like, you know, 45-45-10. And so you have this much, much smaller middle to play to.
Yeah,
Except
that 10 is still incredibly important.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm agreeing. But I'm saying, but American politics has come down to playing that middle. Getting those people to stay home is what elected Trump. There's the data makes that
over-evident. Well, a lot of those moderate congressmen, too, are the ones that are resigning and retiring. You know, I mean,
the Republicans.
Republicans. Yeah. They're getting out of there, you know, so that's not good either. Yeah.
Okay, and we heard from Paul who says, repeal the tax cut. The fiscal results from the last 2 years have come in, and Trump increased the deficit $2 trillion each year. We're borrowing $1 trillion a year to pay for tax cuts for the rich. Why is any of this okay? I don't think you're going to have a lot of people here saying why.
Well, there was a story that just came out yesterday. It didn't make as much news as I expected, but it turns out that as part of the tax cut, they had actually instructed the IRS to keep withholding down a little bit.
Yes.
So people wouldn't see, you know, such an effect so soon. Turns out now, of course, that that's backfiring because people are seeing smaller refunds.
Right.
And so people, you know, felt like each paycheck was a little bigger, but suddenly now they're discovering their refund is a lot smaller. And since most of America gets refunds, so suddenly the tax bill has really started having some
real impact
implications
on people's
and
lives.
And
yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see if that plays out in any interesting way.
How do you suppose the meeting went between Andrew Cuomo, and the president?
You know, I keep thinking about that hockey game. I was talking to somebody this morning, a hockey game. The guys beat each other's brains out. They hit each other with sticks. And then they walk off the field with their arms around each other.
You think it was like that?
I don't know.
Morning, Ralph. Morning, Sam.
What do you say?
No, that was a cartoon. They have the wolf and the sheepdog, Ralph and Sam. And they would go in, and then they punch the time clock, and then they go after each other and beat each other over the head, and then they'd clock out, and they'd be friends and go to the bar.
Well, you really can't fault Cuomo for trying.
I don't fault him at all. Yeah. I was impressed because the stakes are really high. The loss for New York of revenues has been extraordinary.
And making people move as a result.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Kevin says, interpreter. Good morning. Can the democratically controlled Congress subpoena the interpreter for information into Trump and Putin's meeting that had no readout? The president and Republicans will say no due to executive privilege and national security. But what about the national security of 360 million people in the United States? Democrats should use that logic. And that's Kevin from Melrose, 55300.
Jim is saying no.
So I think, you know, as much as I'd love to see it happen, I don't think it can happen. There are certain people who are very, very protected by this executive privilege rules. And
absolutely.
That's one of them. Those interpreters really are very strictly protected because otherwise you really couldn't have international politics and at a level. So I think you'd see a lot of pushback on that. That said, boy, would I love to know what they said.
We have so few records, too, of a lot of those meetings.
Well, and they've ordered some of the interpreters to actually, you know, get rid of some of those. So, you know, when you go through the old president's things, I'm told those notes are in there that Trump's actually had them destroyed.
What do you think, Judy?
Well, I think for historical purposes, certainly they should be preserved. Even maybe we'd see them in 50 years or 75 years. I don't know whether or not that's ever been legally addressed, whether or not the interpreter could be subject to a subpoena, because could she be accused of destroying documents, although she was instructed to do so by the President of the United States.
John says, panel, perhaps Trump will sign the spending. Did we do this one? Sign the spending bill and then declare national emergency and pull money from emergency funds. This maverick move will play well with his base. He doesn't care if the ploy works or not. It's all about keeping the base and Fox News energized. Well, no, I think, John, you make a very good point here, which is it's never been about the wall itself.
No, it's been
about the wall as a symbol that keeps his people in line. I think that's exactly right.
But it was also about the campaign promise was to build the wall and to make Mexico pay for it. So why isn't the fact that Mexico's not paying for it more of an issue with the people at Fox, the Fox commentary?
You're kidding.
It was a two-pronged promise from my mind, and they should have been in their mind.
But your mind. But that's not their mind.
But there's a new president of Mexico, too.
If you tell me there's a new president of Fox, then I'm on board.
Right. And the administration will claim that there's a roundabout way in which Mexico is actually really going to pay for the wall.
You're already saying it, right?
Taxes on tequila.
Just not true.
Russell says, Trump's rock and hard place. Isn't Donald Trump between a rock and a hard place only in his own mind? Fox News doesn't have the responsibility to answer to the voting public like DT might have to. The choice is his and only his. Russ in Greenfield. And then we heard from Lynn. A presidential state of emergency. Woodrow Wilson called an emergency. The military was called out. Protesters were rounded up and incarcerated. The press was suppressed. So, yes, this is very dangerous and should be discussed. And so we do, Lynn, virtually every day on this program. Sharon says, stupid wall. Good morning, panel. The deal that has been negotiated still funds a quarter of Trump's stupid wall, almost $1.4 billion. That's a lot of money, money that could be spent in so many different and more useful ways. Trump has been compared to a child having a tantrum, and I wholeheartedly agree. But if a child is having a tantrum demanding a cigarette to smoke, I wouldn't give that child one quarter of a cigarette and call that successful negotiation. And that's from Sharon in Haydenville, where everybody goes to the planetarium.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Helen DeFossis, and Jim Hendler make up our panel. We welcome you, and we'll be back right after this. Hello, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and listening to the music of Stan Getz, which is very good. Gets us into a good mood.
Gets us into a
good mood. Getz, G-E-T-Z,
Getz. Gets us into a good mood.
We welcome you and your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Jim Hendler is here. Helen DeFossis is back. You're going home tomorrow, though, right?
I am. It's too cold up here. I forgot upstate New York.
That's fair.
Going home to Virginia where the politics make a lot of sense.
I promise we'll get to that in just a few minutes. And Judy Patrick is here and Alan Chartok. Alan's got a couple letters. We'll do those.
Couple phone calls. Okay, so John says, immigration. Good morning, panel. How can a government not have a jurisdictional line? Is every foreign citizen south of our border entitled to enter our country unlawfully? Media and Democratic Party continue to conflate illegal immigration with lawful immigration. Can someone on the panel explain why, in capital letters, the Democratic Party is adamantly promoting a pro-illegal immigration stance? Best regards. And that's from John in Albany. The only part of the letter that let me just say, if you looked at the deal that the Republicans were pushing, it would have been fewer legal immigrants. So the line is created by them, not by us. We all believe that there should be borders and that people should come in legally. But you don't make it impossible for people to do what they've always been able to do.
Well, right. I think to say that the Democrats are in favor of illegal immigration is incorrect. It's not the truth. But to suggest that we need to have walls along the northern border and the southern border, I think, is impractical.
Okay.
Well, and I think the key is there are a lot of people who think that our immigration laws have been. It's a lot like justice reform. They've been creeping one direction for so long that they've become untenable, unusable. So just as we needed
that?
To do.
I mean, well, creeping.
It's towards less and less legal immigration. It's
oh,
towards
that's true.
More and more
that's
reasons that not to allow mm-hmm. asylum. Mm-hmm. So again, we always had a model where a certain number of people could come in legally. That number has been getting smaller, right? That means you start to have whole sectors of the economy that can't hire anyone legally. Right. And that's what causes a lot of this problem. So, you know, I keep hearing from people who said, well, you know, my grandfather, great-grandfather, whoever came in legally. But if you look at the numbers of people who were allowed through Ellis Island in the 40s, it's way more than we're allowing in nowadays legally. And these are causing a lot of the problems.
And maybe it's that kind of European versus Hispanic difference that seems to make not sense to me, of course, but sense to many of the people who are.
Well, there's clearly that.
Yeah. Okay, so then Vincent, who writes frequently, comment, What the pundits and political advisors continue to miss is that the middle class continues to be screwed over by both parties. Where is it written that Trump owns the older white guy vote? The middle class wants the same thing we've always wanted: jobs, affordable health care, affordable education for our kids, and a retirement. That's what Vincent has to say.
Very wise words. I think both parties should listen to him.
The middle class is, I think, legitimately feeling really put upon.
And Jane says, good morning, panel. Everyone keeps mentioning the Mueller report. Last week's Fresh Air interview with the New York Times journalist Michael Schmidt pointed out that unlike the Ken Starr report, parenthesis and subsequent book in the 90s, there will be no, quote, report per se from the Mueller investigation due to Starr's overreach in the late 90s. The rules around the breadth and depth of the special counsel's power have been severely curtailed. That's true, by the way. While information will be shared with the Attorney General, all that stands to come out of the Mueller investigation, as has already been seen, is indictments. Well, I don't think that's true. You know, I have great hope and expectations that the Mueller report, that Mueller will, in fact, have a great deal that we don't know about and that he's been very careful with. So we can all guess what's coming out of this, that this is going to amount to a big nothing burger. I don't think that's true. I just don't. I can't.
You know, I had forgotten the Ken Starr book. Remember how thick that was?
Oh, my God.
It was a big volume.
Like, did you get to interview him, Joe, on this?
No.
Oh, okay.
Didn't really want to.
I get that.
Okay. Let's talk, since we have a Virginian here, let's talk about Virginia politics. So today is the day that Virginia Governor Ralph Northam was going to sit down and work with the legislature on the budget as if nothing happened.
Oh, wow.
As if the entire administration is not in turmoil. And the people that he is negotiating with no exceptions, I believe, all called for his resignation the last week.
So tell us, Helen, what happens?
Well, I mean, the calls for his resignation, though, have been somewhat muted since we got into the lieutenant governor situation with assault charges against him and charges being brought by now by two women. The optics of going against Justin Fairfax, the first black lieutenant governor, and leaving the two white people who did the blackface distinction left untouched are terrible. Virginia is scared to death of getting into that. And to let the top three resign, then a Republican would take over. The Speaker of the Legislature would take over if the Attorney General, the Lieutenant Governor, and the Governor resign. So we don't really know where to draw the line in Virginia right now. We don't. I'm a member of the Alexandria Democratic Committee. Alexandria is a very, very Democratic town. But everybody, we don't really know what to do at this point. I'm sure there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing.
Is there any discussion, Helen, from what you can ascertain, about which of these crimes is worse? The assault or the blackface?
Oh, see, you know, we were talking about this earlier. Virginia is such a complicated state. I mean, the Confederate role in Virginia has been very, very strong. There's a lot more racist sentiment in parts of Virginia than I ever thought before I moved there. And so in that environment, I mean, blackface is not that old a situation in Virginia, you know? I mean, people remember a lot of controversy about that. So that's considered a terrible thing that Northam did and that the Attorney General got into also. So Justin Fairfax says, well, wait a minute, you know, here I am, your first black elected lieutenant governor. You can't do away with me and keep those two.
And, by the way, for whatever it's worth, he denies it.
He denies
that he ever did the
assault charge.
Oh, yes. And now he's calling for an investigation. And, of course, that will go on and on and on and on.
Calling for an FBI investigation.
Yeah, yeah. So
what I do find interesting is that the Republicans in Virginia have found themselves in a tough position between the whole issue of having backed Kavanaugh, and now they would, you know, can't really turn around and say, oh, well, it's okay that this one we're not going to bother.
Although
I've heard plenty of them say that. They're like, you know, politics doesn't demand
consistency.
No, it doesn't have to be consistent.
And this has national implications as well, because Virginia is in a very important stage, and what the Democrats do in Virginia will be heard throughout the country. How the party handles this.
And we were feeling really good in Virginia, the Democratic Party. You know, we were getting stronger, and we were.
We felt you had a chance to take over the legislature.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we were feeling really positive. And now, I mean, it's like we really don't. We're taking deep breaths every morning before we pick up the paper off the stoop.
But that is, and I would assume that that's bipartisan angst, right? I mean, anybody who lives in the state of Virginia just saying, well, Ari, now who's running the place?
Yeah, exactly. And nobody likes to see, I mean, nowadays politics is held in such low esteem already. Nobody likes to see the entire
Well, they're living
top
up to
leadership.
Their...
yeah. I mean, I'm not happy about it. Even if if we're all Republicans, I wouldn't be happy about it. We don't need any more maligning.
It seems like one of those situations, though, that there is no, there's no good way out for anybody,
with
right?
With Fairfax, the lieutenant governor?
Well, with anybody. I mean, if Northam stays, the optics are bad. If Northam goes, the optics are bad. If Fairfax goes, the optics are bad. If Fairfax stays, the optics are bad.
Yeah.
And then you have the attorney general also in the mix.
Northam, I think, of course, his worst problem was that first day when he said, you know, I apologize for all of it, and then tried to deny it all. I think this kind of humble pie thing that he's running now, that I promise to let myself be educated about race and spend my one term, you only have one term in Virginia, spend my one term educating the rest of the Commonwealth about racial polarity.
See, I find that to be insulting.
Why?
Well, why is he? It's he who screwed up?
Yeah.
It's saying like, why is he teaching everybody else about, like, we already knew that was bad. He was the idiot.
Well, yeah,
but also in the reconciliation tour, so far he's been really lousy at that.
I know.
He doesn't seem to be. The more he speaks, the more he tends to.
But he's still trying to save his own hide, too.
Well, you know,
that's why he keeps going on this tour.
So having lived down there for a long time, you know, the other thing that's interesting in Virginia that's very different from here because of the one-term governorship, the two most likely next governors are usually the lieutenant governor and the AG on the same party. So either if the party switches, that's not true. But wherever they're for the past very long time, when the party has stayed in power, it's almost always been one of those two positions. So that's the other thing you're looking at.
I would say this is a wrinkle.
Yeah. I would say this is wrinkle.
Yes. All right. We've got a couple of minutes. Let's talk about Jim sent me a very interesting thing yesterday, and hopefully, and I didn't even get to ask him about this, but hopefully we were looking for just sort of a generalized article about this. Did I find one?
Oh, yeah. Very good.
Okay. One, this is the House panel is going to hold a hearing on data privacy legislation. This is one of your fields of study, sir, so I want you to be able to handle this. But later this month, they'll look at data privacy legislation. It'll take place one day before the Senate holds a hearing on the same topic. House Energy and Commerce Chairman Frank Pallone Jr. on Wednesday announced that the Consumer Protection Subcommittee will hold the hearing on February 26th. This all comes out as the GAO, the Government Accountability Office report, came out that suggested that Congress should consider developing comprehensive legislation on internet privacy that would enhance consumer protections and provide flexibility to address a rapidly evolving internet environment.
So as all your listeners are falling asleep, let me make it clear why this is important. You know, you've had a lot of stories this past week that had internet and internet privacy in it. The Bezos story, some of what's been going on in Virginia, again, that these old pictures now get found and never die, talk about educating people. And really what's going on is a lot of people don't understand just how much of this information is being collected, is being bought and sold. When you put it together, how much that reveals about us. And we have a lot of laws in this country about privacy. Turns out that the internet companies have, to a large degree, been routinely ignoring them.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out there's a couple reasons for that. So this GAO report you mentioned, there were 101 cases in the past couple years where these companies were accused of breaking privacy laws. In almost all those cases, there was a minor settlement, so it's become a cost of doing business. The FTC is not allowed to put penalties, so In the medical domain, if you violate the HIPAA, the medical rules, the penalties are insanely high, and we could get into a whole different story about that. But these internet privacy rules were built around at a time of anti-regulation, where Silicon Valley was being seen as the driver of our economy. Now those big companies have become the biggest companies in the world. They're calling a lot of the shots. They're very worried about regulation. And this privacy stuff is really important. But, you know, I just recently wrote an article, and I have a picture, and I'd love to share with people. But it's I just went to several common websites, a news site, a place where people buy things, a shoe site. In each of the sites, you can track how many other things got to see the information. And it would be 28 or 30 companies. And that's just the first group who can then sell that information to other groups. So the ability, it's called targeted advertising, but it's also what allows a lot of this political problems. So again, you know, on one hand, you have free speech rights. On the other hand, we do have limits on what you can say on television and on the radio, much less so what you can say on the internet. And those kind of things are really all now coming to a head. We saw the election meddling.
Yeah.
Have a big impact, and it's getting worse.
We had a creepy moment in the Donahue household the other night, and not that that's news, but the my wife was at her desk, and she was working, and I was in the living room, and I was planning for a trip, and I was booking a hotel in Texas, and a trip my wife knew we were going on, obviously, but still, and I'm booking the thing. As I'm doing this, my wife is on Facebook and turns to me and says, "Oh, why are you looking at Hilton's?" You know, and all because all of a sudden, within a second of that, the advertising just starts to infiltrate the Facebook page. The fact that that is done, I certainly knew. The rapidity of it really shocked me.
And, you know, if all of us in this room went to, say, the New York Times page right now, we would all see different ads.
Right.
And it's done in a real-time auction based on how much information about you people know. If we go, you know, one of the things I find gets people very upset is when they discover that if we all go to the same, so if we all go to pick your favorite store and look at how much some item costs, we'll see different prices. And it'll be based on what the all of this information has been collected. So
what would this law do, though?
There's a lot of issues about how much to it. But the main two things that people are looking for is, one, you should have knowledge about how your information is being shared. Another one that's a little more complicated to say is you could create trusted brokers. So essentially, instead of the information about you, that could be kind of put together with a lot of other people. So you could say, I trust this organization to protect my privacy. So these are called privacy conglomerates.
Goodness.
That the guy who invented the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, is working on some new products to make it so people could really control their own. You could decide what you're willing to share with people. All of a sudden, they'd have to pay you for that information. So you know, you say, hey, Facebook is giving me a free thing. They're, you know, where's Facebook making its money off of what they put on your page? How much of that are you getting? None.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing people really should be careful about is how much they say okay to letting an app let them know where they are. These geographic tracking
apps what we can do with geo tracking, things like that.
They know where you are, where you've been, and they're going to serve you an ad. I was driving by a brewery one time, and a brewery ad popped in. And go, it's very scary.
It has been there is a store. It's been tested in Europe. It hasn't happened in the U.S. yet. And Europe has put some very strong privacy rules, and so a lot of the model the U.S. is looking at comes from that. It's something that basically says you need to consent to your information being shared, but. Some of these things are like you walk past a store window and it recognizes you in a camera and is showing you an ad in the store window that's tailored to you. And if a few people are walking by, it tries to find something that all of those people would be interested in. I mean, it's a stunning amount of technology. And again, if the government does it, we would say, oh my God, that's big creepy. Brother. That's terrible. Yeah. The big brother. But we're letting big companies.
So
do
who are the
stuff
guilty parties here? Like Facebook itself or the advertisers?
All of the above. I mean, it's Facebook, Google, Amazon. You get into some other companies, depending exactly which side of this. Apple. Apple's actually been pretty good now about realizing that privacy was going to be an issue and trying to rule some of that in. So it's very tough.
Are we forgetting, is there a segment of the population that would, as to use Judy's analogy, or even the story I was telling, I mean, they say, oh, cool,
now
this is really, right, that's great, I'm driving by, this is very helpful, this is terrific.
So the key is, to me, I mean, I actually think some of this is good stuff, too, and when it's used right. The question is, do I have control? Do I get to say
right.
something? And so there's a – so we all have different roles in our life, right? So when you go to –
you know it.
When you go to – when you're at work,
yes.
you're a different person than when you're at home. But also, for example, when people go to church, when people go to Boy Scouts, when they go to whatever, you know, you sort of have these different parts of your – thing. In the real world, you can keep those separate. In the online world, you no longer can. And that's really where a lot of this problem is coming from, is we're used to a world where you can do this. Even the millennials, the people who are digital natives, younger ones, you know, who kind of understand better right. this information exchange, are when you really show them some of the implications, who knows what, how it's done, they're not really concerned about people having that information. They're concerned about them having that information without them knowing about it. When they discovered Snapchat actually kept the pictures that they said they deleted. That's the kind of thing where it violated an expectation. And so that's a lot of what we talk about on the technical side of this, is what do people expect? How could we expose those expectations? And then how could we have a legal framework so that the stuff – and if you look at the medical framework, it's like that. When you go to a doctor – if they want to use your data for some kind of research, they have to tell you. They can't just give it away.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
So it sounds like there are laws about this. They just aren't being enforced.
So there are very strong laws in certain sub-areas.
Or well, in area Europe, also? Even in this country?
Well, in the U.S., there's existing regulation that's typically not being used.
I'm sorry, I got to wrap up. My apologies. Judy Patrick, Helen DeFossis, Jim Hendler, Alan Chartok, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Very great
discussion.
Seeing you. We'll be back.